Number five, the sacred and the active life, the holy and a world needing change. Every 24 years, the Martys come to Holden Village, and 20 of us were here this time, building on the original eight. That's what happens in 24 years. It's been a wonderful time to be back, and I look forward to this last session with you. We leave tomorrow. And one of the things that in preparing these lectures, I don't think I thought enough about, though we get good warning from the Wees, is that you have to remember they're new people each time. I sort of have that sense that everything I say will be so memorable that the Monday people will just have it all stuck in their minds for Tuesday, and we just build along the way, and then there are a lot of new faces each time. So, this week, we've taken quite seriously and quite literally the theme, the motif, the motto, the rubric for this summer at Holden Village, listen to the sacred, or listen for the sacred, or look for the sacred, and that has necessitated some defining, or at least pointing to where we think it is, since you can't quite define the sacred. We reminded ourselves that the word profane, which is the opposite of the sacred, literally means that which is across the threshold from the temple. Those people out there are in the profane world, and we're in the sacred world. We learned this week that's not how it works. There's a lot of profaneness inside the temple, and there's a lot of the sacred outside it, but we are reminding ourselves that that's where the word came from. The sacred points to that which goes beyond our normal experience, that which is mysterious, not immediately accessible, transcendent, other, different, majestic, awe-inspiring, shattering, beguiling. Whereas the alternative to the sacred is not simply the profane, but that which is easily accessible, the open, the simple, that which we can exhaust in a certain sense, the practical dimensions of life. We pointed to the sacred. In the world of nature, the first day we started talking about how for some of us it is just letting the mountain work upon us and reminding ourselves of how little we are among these eternal hills, or the beauties of other elements of nature, the retina of the eye of the deer, the daffodil one of you mentioned. We talked about the sacred as being those manifestations, those breaking through of otherness in our brothers and sisters in need, or those who are caregivers and helpers. We talked about how the sacred comes in the biblical tradition, building upon the fact that we are aware of a creator, aware of a God who visits us in the creation. It's built upon by story. And so we made a great deal about sacred story. Stories that once they've happened, you can't get behind because you become a part of their life. We are in the sacred struggle of the Jacobs and in the sacred calls of the Abraham, in the sacred time with the disciples dozing a little in the Garden of Gethsemane or wherever. We made those distinctions throughout, working our way, I think, to the delightful point of seeing how in our world, our profane world, our world of graffiti and obscenity and violence, we can set aside times and places in the day, in the year, in the seasons, in our personal lives in the many stages, in our crises, in our joys. We can set aside times in which we can let the sacred work upon us. And I couldn't have stressed enough, I hope, yesterday, that the act of worship and being near the sacred doesn't have to be practical. It has its own intrinsic value. The flower that you so enjoy doesn't have to exist because you can grind it up and make something that'll sweeten up your closet or something like that. It just exists. It just is. It's just beautiful. Nature is full. It's prodigal. I have a colleague who says, the world is so full of awful things, so much terror, so many malignancies, so much hatred and violence, that we have to channel it into a place where we can find stories and words for it, and we call that worship. And the world is so full of grace and the unmerited and the kindness and the care of others. There's just no way in the prodigality of grace in the world for us to sustain it all. We'd be busting out in tears or laughter all the time. And so we organize it through worship. And it does its own thing right there. But that's not the end of the story. And tonight I'd like to address what I think, biblically, is not the end of the story, but the further movement for all of us who have to be realistic about the fact that whether we stay or go at Holden Village, whatever our duties are here or what's ahead where we go, we do go back into a world in which the sacred is not all that manifest or common, where it needs to be attended to, where it is visible in the world of need, in the face of the Christ in our sister, our brother, in the wonders all around us that need attention. That's why I call it the holy, which is another part of the word sacred. Holy in a world needing change. Early in this century, there was a great Catholic journalist in France, Charles Péguy, P-E-G-U-Y, who had a little aphorism that stuck with me for a long time and is the text for the evening meditation. He said, "Everything begins in mysticism and ends in politics." Now, by that, by mysticism, he didn't mean mysticism, and by politics, he didn't mean politics, which is my way of saying, as you read all of him, and not just that sentence, you find that each of them points to a larger reality. For most of us, mysticism means that union with God, one-on-one, that the great contemplatives reach. And politics means the ballot box and voting and partisanship and so on. They're both a part of it. But by mysticism, as you read him, you'll find that he's really pointing to what we point at all summer here when we talk about the sacred. That whole realm of the non-practical, which threatens us and beguiles us, which puts us in our place and gives us a new place, which causes us in awe and fear to be reduced and then exalts and magnifies us as the children of God. Everything begins in mysticism was his way of saying that if you think that the world of the practical can sustain itself on its own terms, you soon run out. I've been in many sessions this week where we talk very seriously about the problem of burnout, of volunteering in the life of the church and the community and not being sustained. That's one of the reasons we have Sabbath. It's one of the reasons we have retreat, one of the reasons we come to a mountain place. Because we need that replenishment. You simply cannot be in the world of the polis, the human city, that's the word behind politics, in the world where you have to be producing change. You just cannot do it all the time, all the time, all the time, without a replenishment, which in the circumstances this week we get from the awareness of the sacred, the holy. Everything begins in mysticism and ends in politics. Or let me take another illustration. One of the great post-World War II statespersons, I suppose we'd say, General Secretary of the United Nations in its early years, was Dag Hammarskjöld. Any of you who ever saw him in action, in person or in television or anything, would have thought him as the most suave, practical, pointed political figure there could be. Because no one knew what the United Nations might become, there was hope for it. Everyone is trying to break it apart as well, and he is constantly shuttling and making compromises. And then he's killed in a plane crash, and somebody's going through his things in a hotel in New York, and they find Wegmarken, which is translated markings, which is one of the great contact with the sacred books of our time. All the while, I would say he moonlit as a mystic. He'd be in the world of politics all day, and then he'd replenish himself by going back and reflecting about these things. He'd say great things like, you dare your yes, God's yes comes to you, and you dare your yes, and then all the consequences follow. Hammarskjöld once said, "In our era, the road to holiness necessarily passes through the world of action." I've been around long enough to have watched several eras of life in church, in religious organizations, where people trying to make a difference in the world have used different strategies. And one of them that I think we look back to as being a model that's kind of exhausted now, all I have to do is to say for older people in the room, the 60s, and everybody has a certain image. The church activist, a pronouncement of the day or the week, one year the United Methodist passed 63 social pronouncements. I never met a United Methodist who hadn't been to the convention, who ever heard one of them. I never heard of any corporation that trembled or so on. And also good things came out of it. The shattering power. Remember the civil rights activism. Did the church have a role in it? Yeah. Senator Russell hated it, said, we wouldn't have this awful legislation if it weren't for the goddamn clergy who were out there. And Senator Hubert Humphrey, who liked it, said, we wouldn't have this if it weren't for the wonders of those priests, rabbis, ministers, nuns, and lay people out there. So that's pretty good proof both sides felt that way about it. And today all sides admit that some good things came out of it. But another thing that happened was not everybody in it was in contact with the sacred. A lot of it got to be bureaucratic or programmatic. I used to say some of us were out there because our great-grandparents used to sing the hymns. But 1,000 years from now, or 100 years from now, or whenever people think back, I think they're going to remember that at the heart of the movement were people like the Reverend Martin Luther King. Almost all the leadership was the Reverend. A great black figure in Detroit some years ago talked about the religiosification of the black movement and the civil rights movement. The religiosification, it's not in the dictionary. Dictionary doesn't really need the word, but it's kind of neat, isn't it? He's assuming that in a world where everybody was secular, all of a sudden all these reverends are out there, and a lot of them were as secular as anybody else, but a few of them, and I would say Martin Luther King, for all his flaws, is an example of that. The night he dies, he's on the way to preach a sermon. One week, the Martys and the Martin Luther Kings did a thing together in Hampton, Virginia. I was irrelevant by nightfall. I gave my lecture, and they turned off their tape recorders and so on. But there we'd be outside the little housing place, and Burning Bush Baptist would say, Reverend King, can you come and preach to us? He said, oh, man, I'm preaching at First Baptist at 8, and I'm preaching and such at 9:30. You know, good and well, he's going to be there by 9:30 because Baptist services don't end that quickly. Well, we'll be there at 11. It would be more like 11:30. Well, we'll be 11:30. He was doing three or four of them a night and drawing constantly on that. Dorothy Day, another example. Dorothy Day was the great Catholic lay figure of our time. She never quite fit. She never quite fit. Was she left? Was she right? She was a pacifist in World War II, which wasn't really a way to gain a lot of support. She started all of these Catholic worker homes. You'd give her and her movement money. They still exist. Some of you may have been part of them. You give them money, and you want them to paint the pipes. No, they wash the pipes one more time because there are that many hungry people. There's bread out there. She never was all that in, but there are a lot of Catholics who think that some future pope, once he's done with the current one with Opus Dei and his particular list of saints, is likely to say, hey, this woman was a saint. And she was really weird, if you're an activist, in this sense. She was such a loyal Catholic that she said, if Cardinal Spellman, my archbishop, if Cardinal Spellman says, Miss Day, stop it tomorrow, I would stop it because I'm a daughter of the church and I believe in the church. He'd be wrong, but I'd follow. She had a pre-Vatican II piety. She wrote this wonderful column, Bread and Fishes, Bread and Loaves, Bread and Fishes. Year after year, she wrote this little column for her newspaper. You can get collections of them. I think there's some of them over here. Well, if she were here, she'd be a little nervous about that we had real bread for communion. She was content with these little plastic-looking sliver hosts. Dan Barry going to come by and he'd have an earthenware vessel. Well, she liked the old silver thing with the little jewels in that Cardinal Spellman had. She didn't know why he needed all that change because this was her way of being in contact with the sacred. Now, the Days, the Kings, the Thomas Mertons, the Pope John the 23rds, the people who are remembered, the Dag Hammarskjölds, as the people of action for our time that people might follow tomorrow, I think are those who regularly cycled back. They knew their limits, and they had to be told their limits. They had to be in contact with the sacred, which for some came through that sacrament, for others came through the Baptist preaching, for others came through meditation, Journal of the Soul by John the 23rd, marvelous diary of simplicity. They could always be replenished to get back in there. So in our era, the road to holiness necessarily passes through the world of action. Everything begins in mysticism and ends in politics. I think it's an important message for us to hear because my experience of Holden Village has always been we're trying to do two things. We're trying to go deeper. We're trying to have retreat. We're trying to be refreshed. We're trying to say you don't have to go to anything, and you can just sit and listen to the stream go by and let the world out there be forgotten for a week. 5:10 every morning on our porch, it goes thump, thump. And that's the New York Times, Chicago Tribune, and I'm a junkie, and if by 5:30 I haven't read them both, the world will come to an end. Here I'm 36 hours behind, and the world has been going along just as well as if I were an activist out there. And all the while, too, look at the racks of resources. We're constantly being impelled to say there is a very real world out there of hungry people and suffering people and so on. And we need to be involved also with that. So the two keep coming together. But I think it's very easy for us to tilt one way or the other and go home and think we're either the sacred worshipers or we're the active activists. And it is true that sometimes the language of action in the world can be divorced from the action that we see in the sacred of the pastoral care and prayer or whatever. In the 60s, when a marvelous theology of hope was born, I mentioned Dorothea Sölle, I could mention Jürgen Moltmann, plenty of these people have their books in the library here. We were all talking about theology of hope and change, political theology, liberation theology. A Catholic lay theologian, Monica Hellwig, said, "I like your theology of hope, but you have to remember you're all who are writing it are tenured. You're all middle and upper middle class. You're all in a world where you at least have the illusion that what you're doing by word or deed or writing is going to change something. I'm not interested," she said, "in any theology of hope that doesn't also talk to the cancer ward. It doesn't talk to the people who don't have earthly hope. It don't talk to people who are senior citizens and are forgotten in the last segregation. I'm not interested in any theology of hope that doesn't bridge those two." Monica Hellwig knows everything begins in mysticism, ends in politics, but life cycles them back along the way. Now, you can't do everything at the same time. Last night I quoted a favorite line of Rousseau, who says, "You can expect my thoughts to be consistent with each other, but you can't expect me to assert them all at the same time." And so it is with our lives. I, for one, all my life have really, really, really enjoyed the arts. I found a paper the other day. There's a magazine called Dialogue, wants some theological autobiographies, and they want somebody out in the quadrangle, an 11-year-old, just guessed that I was 75. She guesses ages. I'm 65. She guessed 75. And I think Dialogue figures, you know, these creaky old guys have to say how they got where they got. And I thought I at least have, I'm a historian, you need documentation. And the only document I could find was Thanksgiving 1946 in college. The grandfather of Ann Genap. Is Ann here? She's too busy around here. Who knows Ann? She's on the staff. What is she, head garbologist or head maverick? She's everything. I mean, I see her slinging garb. I see her doing everything. Well, her grandfather, to whom I've dedicated a book, was the only writing teacher I ever had. And so I really owe a lot to that that family line. And he made us imagine 50 years from then, 1990. No, it was 1948. 1996, we'd imagine. Well, that went by pretty fast. And I started reading what I thought back then. And what was interesting to me was I said, I would have given anything to be a musician. But after 8 years of clunking piano, I knew it'd never be that. I did art for a while. I even made a living in art for a while. But I knew enough I wasn't very good at it. So I just enjoy it. I'm a junkie for organ, symphony. I mean, the lights go down. It happens. I'm there. And I'm always telling churches to invest in the arts and get a good organ and let the tapestries come and all that. And then somebody else says, but what kind of stewardship is that when there's all that need out there? Yeah. I think the two go together. I think that if these point to the sacred, they do give the chance of ennobling us to be inspired to get out in it. But you can't do the same at the same time. We are in different modes, different universes of discourse along the way. And now we're in the discourse of action. For that, I gave you a text. I don't know how many of you had. I had 100 printed, so did y'all get one? If you didn't, you know it from memory anyhow, but you need a souvenir of the week. And I just thought if you had one to take home, it would be a little more vivid to you. It really is Isaiah's comment on Hammarskjöld and Peggy. He knew they were going to say that in the 20th century. So the second Isaiah gets geared up for this, because I think this really brings the two together. I don't know anything to do except do the whole thing. This is liturgical reform, biblical style. Then we're finding out here just how important it is to God, just how we're doing all this. The Lord says, through the prophet, shout as loud as you can, tell my people Israel about their sins. They worship me every day. Listen to the sacred. Claiming that they're eager to know my ways and obey my laws. They say they want me to give them just laws and that they take pleasure in worshiping me. Last night's lecture. The people ask, why should we fast if the Lord never notices? Solidarity noon. Why should we go without food if he pays no attention? Obviously, there's a broken down communication between the sacred and the people wanting experience of the sacred. The Lord says to them, the truth is that at the same time you fast, you pursue your own interests and oppress your workers. In other words, you can be engrossed in the right of getting access to the sacred and overlooking the sacred calling. Your fasting makes you violent. What we do here is we fast and then we go to the snack bar mid-afternoon to minimize the violence. But if you've ever tried a long fast, you get pretty crabby, right? It is, you're supposed to. And you quarrel and fight. Do you think this kind of fasting will make me listen to your prayers? When you fast, you make yourself suffer. You bow your heads low like a blade of grass and spread out sackcloth and ashes to lie on. Is that what you call fasting? Do you think I will be pleased with that? And this is the sacred breaking through the prophet. The kind of fasting I want is this. Remove the chains of oppression and the yoke of injustice and let the oppressed go free. Share your food with the hungry and open your homes to the homeless poor. Give clothes to those who have nothing to wear. Here's the tough one, and do not refuse to help your own relatives. Malinowski, the great anthropologist, said, aggression like charity begins at home. Then, now listen, now we're back to the sacred and the worship. Those of you who are of Lutheran tradition know you can't have gospel without law and law without gospel, right? They kind of drum that into you. It's a pretty heavy law. Now listen to the beauty of this. Then my favor will shine on you like the morning sun, and your wounds will be quickly healed. I will always be with you to save you. My presence will protect you on every side. When you pray, I will answer you. When you call to me, I will respond. If you put an end to oppression, to every gesture of contempt, and to every evil word, if you give food to the hungry and satisfy those who are in need, then the darkness around you will turn to the brightness of noon. Remember our first day of the sacred? Light plays a big part. Epiphany. I had time last night to go into all the biblical epiphanies. I talked to some organists recently, and I told them, in the visual arts, what would we do with children's literature if people long ago didn't wear gowns? Because, or robes, or togas, or whatever, bathrobes, whatever you wore when you're in a Christmas pageant. Because you need a long draping arm, because you're doing that all the time, right? The shepherds out in the field, right? Shepherds, the women, Easter morning. There's always some bright thing coming, too much for us, fear not. Brightness is a big part of the message of the sacred, epiphany, showing forth. And that's the promise way back then already. Darkness around you will turn to the brightness of noon, and I will always guide you and satisfy you with good things. I will keep you strong and well. You will be like a garden that has plenty of water. That's a sacred ring to it. Like a spring of water that never goes dry. Your people will rebuild what has been in ruins, building again on the old foundations. You will be known as the people who rebuilt the walls, who restored the ruined houses. That's great these days. And finally, because Sabbath is sacred, and the word even gets here. The Lord says, if you treat the Sabbath as sacred, I think in our translation, New Testament people, we say Sabbath is that constituted time set aside for access to the sacred, for God to speak to us, for Christ to come to us. If you treat that as sacred and do not pursue your own interests on that day, if you value my holy day and honor it by not traveling, working, or talking idly on that day, then you will find the joy that comes from serving me. I think our modern analogy to that is the joy we do find. I remember at the end I said last night that full Christian worship, experience of the sacred, helps us let go of that to which we'd been clinging in false security, including our evil, without regret, and therefore worship is always celebrative. You'll find the joy that comes from serving me. I will make you honored all over the world, and you'll enjoy the land I gave to your ancestor Jacob. I, the Lord, have spoken. Take that home and sort of look at it now and then, because it's sort of the summary of what this has been leading to. Today, the path to holiness is necessarily through the world of action. Everything begins in mysticism and ends in politics. One of my sacred duties the first 4 days this week was to keep my commitment to the bookstore and hold up a book that I told them. And I got off the plane the other day and got in the boat line, and I noticed number 5, when I think up one, I'll put it here. I didn't think up one in time, so there's none there. So I don't get to plug one, because the one I would plug isn't in the bookstore. But just irrelevantly, just for fun, someday look up a book by Glenn Tinder, The Christian Meaning of Politics. It's really a frustrating book. He's a Lutheran lay person in Amherst, Mass. Nobody could quite make sense of where he came from. I've never met a professional Lutheran theologian that talks more clearly than he. He doesn't talk about the Zweireichenlehre and all these other things that we think somebody ought to catch on to, but nobody ever does. It's a frustrating book, because if you're a liberationist and you're on the left and you're radical, his text is, those that wait for the Lord will renew their strength. Yeah, be active, but it's God who acts. And if you're on the right, yeah, you got to hold on to the good things from the past, but I make all things new. And if you wait upon the Lord, he will renew your strength. Glenn Tinder, T-I-N-D-E-R, like Tinder that burns things. It's an amazingly different, funny kind of book. And when he asks what is it is for the Christian to be in politics, since he's decided in advance there's no particular strategy, polity, or party through which you get at the things I say is talking about. You all have to get there, but there's no particular strategy you can call God's own. He says the two things that are always essential when the Christian has had the contact with the sacred and wants to move into the world of action: one, to remember that you are and you are dealing with, quote, the exalted individual. Nothing you do in politics dare overlook the exalted individual. And his theme is that, because this is the exalted individual to the Christian is a member of that race which God is a part of in Jesus Christ. Karl Barth, some people think the greatest theologian of this century, wrote I think 17 volumes of Kirchliche Dogmatik. When he was in Chicago, the only time he came to America, somebody said, "Can you summarize that in one sentence?" And he said, "Yeah, Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible told me so." But he was very learned, and his footnotes were extensive. And he had one 50,000-word footnote, which became a book called Christ and Adam. And he said, one of the problems we have in the church is we look at each other always and only in Adam. We bond our church treasure, or we'd better. We have padlocks. We lock the door. We have committees, we have auditors. In our rest of our life, we're suspicious. We have burglar alarms. We try to diselect certain kinds of people. We see each other in Adam. We really do know that about each other. We might have the most sunny visions of human nature because they're kind of fun to put in books. But in real life, we use locks. But he said the Christian also has to look at each other in Christ and see everybody as a member of that race which God in Christ has redeemed. Martin Luther had the shocking way of saying, not that you should be as Christ, you should be an alter Christus, another Christ, another one. That's pretty high stuff. And the people you're dealing with, those broken bodies, those depressed people, those errant ones, those delinquents, those druggies or whatever, somehow you have to see them as the exalted individual, at least in your hope. And the other thing, when you've been in contact with the sacred, is that you belong to a prophetic community. A prophetic community. What does the sacred do to produce it? Prophetic community is a word you could throw.
Church looked pretty secure. We threw a few stones to the stained glass windows. The book sold well enough that we got launched in our careers. We were bright young men, and we were all at the same conference. And Peter Berger, some of you know him, said to the other two of us, get out your billfold. Every review I've seen of these three books together says these are three new prophets. Get out your billfold. Got any credit cards? I had two. Gibb had three. You're not prophets. I'm not a prophet. If you got a credit card, you can't be a prophet. You're invested in the system. Got any stocks? Well, if you're in a pension plan, you got stocks, right? You're in the system. We're not prophets. You'll be critics. You'll never know who a prophet was till maybe 1,000 years later. And you probably wouldn't know their names now. I said maybe Dorothy Day was, maybe Martin Luther King was, maybe John the 23rd was, maybe Thomas Merton was. But we don't really know. But we belong to a prophetic community, which means no policy we've adopted, no hymn book we've approved, no pattern of service we have, no retreat centers that we build, no pieties that we develop, no expressions that we have are God. The great temptation to idolatry is there. The prophetic community is the one that keeps saying that we are in touch with the sacred in order that it always reaches into our world and we see the distance between God and who we are. And then after we've seen that, we are impelled, says Glenn Tinder, and now I in translation, to go back into our many different callings. And they're very different. They can all be a part of this vision of the exalted individual and the prophetic community. The organist. Oh, somebody said, you always tell who the organist is because they wear shiny slacks or pants. They slide on and off the bench all the time. Spend their whole life pulling these knobs and pressing these keys, and someday they die, and it was an ex-organist. How did they serve? They really did. They honor the exalted individual with that roar and that sweetness. They help the prophetic community sing. Back in those years called the 60s, the students demanded that we all become relevant. And at our university, that meant we were all to have courses on the city. Well, that wasn't really hard for someone like me who teaches history of American religion in the 20th century. You can't be irrelevant because you're right in the middle of it. But old Hans Güterbach, an Assyriologist, had a real hard time. So he decided to teach a course on the ancient Assyrian city to be relevant. Well, after about 3 days of it, the students came and said, Professor Güterbach, would you please try to be irrelevant again? All these years, you gave us the exemplary vision of someone doing his business well. They didn't use these words. I'm translating it. You were just a good prof. You just took this stuff and you just loved it so much that we loved it. And now you're trying to make it something else than what it is. I've always used that as kind of a symbol in my mind that each of us are to do what we're doing. You know that story about somebody who comes across some people and asks, what are you doing? It's a wonderful sermon illustration. It's been used as a statistic here. So 183,412 times, I think, up to last Sunday. What are you doing? And the first person is mixing mortar. I'm mixing mortar. And what are you doing? Well, I'm chipping stone. And what are you doing? I'm glazing. You go through about 20 of these things, and you finally come to somebody who's got the muckiest job of all. What are you doing? I'm helping build a cathedral. And I remember the old comic Gary Moore said, he wasn't supposed to be building a cathedral. He's supposed to be building a gas station. In other words, the sermon illustration suggests that if the sacred is only seen in the great edifice, then we're fulfilling the calling. No, it's the shiny trousers. It's the old Assyriologist. It's the person with the mortar doing their thing in which the sacred calling is lived out along the way. In a world that needs change, the church, as a prophetic community in our time, is very busy trying to find ways to do it appropriately in our time. There's no single strategy. We get to travel a great deal. I've spent some time in South Africa. Very different strategies there. Spend a little bit of time in Guatemala. Different strategies. Everywhere you go, depending upon age, gender, social location, calling, there are just all kinds of strategies needed to fulfill what we're talking about. But one of the things that is being re-explored in our society, not the only way to change the world, but a way to participate in it, is the recovery of the world of the volunteer. Some of you know that I sometimes get called by magazines and so on to say, what are trends in religion? I always say, well, the most important one is one you never want to bother to write about. The most important trend is that, according to Robert Withnow of Princeton, who knows about these things, takes surveys, does all those dull things sociologists do, and comes up with the awareness that probably as many Americans as ever volunteer. 45% of American adults are in some weekly volunteering. It didn't go down. The people said 30 years ago when women added workforce outside the home to their workforce inside the home, there it goes. No, they find a way and men compensate and the need is there. You wouldn't begin to touch all the social needs of our society through volunteering, but you can sure hit a lot of things that wouldn't hit otherwise. And about two-thirds of that volunteering, dollars and hours, comes through religious organization. And most interesting to me is that those who get hooked on it through the church also do it more secularly. Now, we have a lot to learn. I have family members here who know that on my office door at home and at school, I have Pogo has a famous saying, we have faults we haven't even used yet. And the church has faults it hasn't even used yet. There's some marvelous secular humanists down the block who shame us by what they do in the human city. We better know that. But I think we've underestimated the way in which, in any city, any day, any night, an awful lot is happening. I've often suggested that you could take a 30 church bulletins from a medium-sized city and just list the things that they're doing in a particular week that go beyond themselves. Doing their own thing isn't failing to serve the city. I know some people say, oh, there are 200 members and they're mainly old. Well, what are they doing? Well, serving the old is a rather big deal. We 75-year-olds-to-be like me say, I mean, don't forget about us. But nobody takes care of them better than each other. And so the wonderful thing of congregations doing that. Homeless, AIDS. Remember a few years ago, Cardinal O'Connor was on the pan because he wouldn't hire gays because of church policy for his agencies. And somebody said, well, who cares? Well, somebody said, who cares? He's administering $70 million of tax funds every year. I watch. I'm a suspicious Snoopy type. I watch for the letters to the editor saying that's violating separation of church and state. I didn't see a single letter. Why? Because everybody knows that for whatever flaws are there, the Catholic Archdiocese is the most efficient administrator of that. It's got all the volunteers, cheapest wages, and all the rest that goes with it. 58% of Salvation Army funds in our Chicago area are tax funds. When you put that stuff in the red bucket, all you're doing is enabling them to be the most efficient administrators of something else. Any of you who are in social service agencies know that there is this that goes on and blends along the way. And nobody worries about church and state on it because they see the human service here. I think this is something we haven't done enough. But what am I leading up to? What is Withnow saying that ties together some of our themes this week? We in the church, and I want to talk as a Christian, are not the only custodians of the language of the sacred. All the faiths, all the religions, all the people at the edges of the religions can have experience of the sacred, the uncanny, the mysterious, the mountain, the beauty, the daffodil, the face of the child, the still small voice. But when you move into the orbit of biblical faith, the Hebrew Scriptures, Old Testament, Judaism, and when you move into the orbit of the Christian community, which is the vastly, overwhelmingly largest one in our country, the sacred takes on a special character that I hope showed through every day, but should be most vivid now. And in Robert Withnow's book, it takes on the character of story. Why do these people do this? And his hypothesis at the end of his book is people volunteer when they share a story, are a story, and tell stories. You get all kinds of people to have a one-night emotional jag and act. You get a lot of volunteers for one night. But if you want to talk about 12 years of Alzheimer's care or 2 years of AIDS care or whatever, you're going to have people who are motivated. As I read Withnow, he says what you always knew. That's what sociologists do. They tell you what you always knew, but they have data behind it. Saul Alinsky used to say, University of Chicago sociologist spent $250,000 to give you a map of what every sailor at Great Lakes knows, where the brothels. Sociologists know these things, what you know. What do you know, Withnow says, that you can't command people to volunteer. You can't moralize them into volunteering. You can't deceive them into volunteering. You can't beguile, seduce, tease them into volunteering. They volunteer when they become a part of a story, of a community of people that build things on each other. Now that I've used his name several times, I should spell it out, W-U-T-H-N-O-W, Robert Withnow, and the book is The Acts of Compassion. Two books tonight that I should have put on the list. When we tell the stories, for us, the sacred is not merely a burning bush, but it's the story of a burning bush. It's not just the wrestling with a mysterious figure, but it's the story of that wrestling. It's not just that Jesus was in the Garden of Gethsemane praying, but that we're involved with his prayer. A prayer of action that doesn't end with thy will be done. He keeps on praying. I think that the storied character of the exalted individual, God in Christ, Christ in us, the prophetic community, the community that's always judged because it profanes the sacred, it hardlines it, it domesticates it, it dissolves it, that prophetic community constantly needs to remind itself of the two extremes of last night and tonight, the pointless but significant and the pointed that moves out into a world needing change. Some years ago, when people thought for a minute and a half or a season and a half that this was going to be the age of Aquarius, remember we used to sing those songs, it'll be the age of Aquarius, everything's going to turn out all right. Have you looked out the window lately? The image was pretty much that if you just stared at the mountain or went to a ravine in the edge of Orange County and said om, or chewed the right stuff or smoked the right stuff or grew the right hair, all would be well. And Kenneth Boulding, a marvelous Quaker economist, Elise's husband, said, have you ever thought about who Aquarius is? If you know anything about the zodiac, who is the Aquarius? He's the water bearer, right? There's the stars. There he is, trudging across the heavens eternally, working out the Presbyterian work ethic. And Boulding says, that's how the world gets changed, by the Aquarius, who is not only the image of the disengaged, aware of the sacred, but someone then who takes up the task along the way. The sacred sacralizes the profane world, said Peggy. The world of environment and nature needs changing. I think it's changed when we see the sacred in it and we have the story of how to treat it. The social bond, as intimate as the family and the friendship, but also how do people form societies? When has it ever been more troubling than now? Bodily presence, I talked about 2 days ago, the sacredness of the act of healing, of the body that God gave us, of the mind and the soul, of women and men who are catching on now and then to it, of action in the world. Peggy, who seems to be my quotable tonight, says, of the people who think that to deal with the sacred you have to get out of the world into ethereal mysticism, quote, if one would raise oneself to the eternal, it is not enough to depreciate the temporal. To raise oneself to grace, it's not enough to depreciate nature. To raise oneself to God, it's not enough to depreciate the world. Some of us may have a little problem with the Augustinian language of raising ourselves, but let's allow that. It's being grasped by the sacred. People believe that because they have not the strength or the grace to belong to nature, they belong to grace. They believe that because they lack temporal courage, they have passed the threshold of the eternal. They believe that because they have not the boldness to be worldly, they are godly. They believe that because they're not brave enough to be on the human side, they believe they are on God's side. Not belonging to the human, they think they belong to God. Because they love nobody, they believe they love God. And yet, Jesus Christ was a human among us. I hope enough has shown through this week for you to know that I like to take the sacred very seriously. but I also like to do the holy hilarity along the way. So I want to remind you a little bit of finding the sacred in everything through another Hasidic story of someone who thought the sacred could be found only apart from the world. There's a rich tradition in Judaism and deeper in Christianity of asceticism, askesis, doing without. It's a marvelous part of spiritual disciplines. It's the way the sacred can reach you. But in the fullness of the biblical story, it isn't all there's to it. Anyhow, this wonderful Hasid read those texts about how you should do without, do without, do without, do without. And he thought he wanted to get to paradise, and he would do without. And so he did without all the good-tasting food. And he did without and never tasted the good wines. And he never listened to the good music or saw the good people or the good art. He really abstracted himself from all of that. And of course, the text said so, and it was true, he met his reward. He got to paradise. And 3 days later, they had to throw him out because he couldn't understand anything that was going on there. In the midst of our sorrowing world, we already get a foretaste of the sacred. My favorite line about music from Bach, that music is God's greatest gift to his sorrowing creatures to give them a joy worthy of their destiny. I run that through all kinds of things. Friendship, it's these little middle-sized things. The theologians are really good at hate and love, but the middle-sized things like friendship, they're sacred. The bonds we make at places like this and dealing with each other, people come to us in our need and expect us in their need. We like them. We test them. Friendship. Politics, the middle size. Politics doesn't save souls. It doesn't make sad hearts glad, but it minimizes the violence we'd have in the world. And through compromise and bargaining and rhetoric and working away, we make some address to a world of change. That's why I think the sacred is found so many places, but always necessarily in our time, where God's call to action bids us to follow. Thank you. Profs are incurable. They send us these things that say you shouldn't be sage on stage. Well, I'm not on stage. I'm not a sage either, come to think of it. What they mean is don't filibuster. But I'm a prof, and I'm born to talk 50 minutes. So to get it down to 47, 30, and 88 hundredths is its own achievement, but that only gives us 12 minutes. Let's use them well. Anybody got some questions, comment, rejoinder, added illustrations? Please. Okay, how about 2 years from now? Good question, though. I'd love to tangle it a little bit, just a little bit. The issue is we're 2,000 years into the Christian tradition, 2,800 in the prophetic tradition. We've done certain adapting along the way. What'll it be like in the long pull future? One of the things I like about the question is I think it's really marvelous if we can shake ourselves loose from being too bound to the time. Too bound to the time. If we adapt everything to this year, we're going to forget a lot of wonderful things. Remember my Gershom Scholem line? They knew some things back there that we do not know already, that we do not know as yet. It's a big part of the sacred and of worship. But it has to be in a language appropriate in changing times. And they will change greatly. But they do shake us a lot. I like to say that the things in the church that are in trouble today were invented between 1740 and 1840. And I find that the most liberating thing. The denomination, the modern competitive parish, the modern mission movement, the Sunday school, the voluntary associate, they're all invented in early industrial, early democratic times in England, Northwest Europe, America, now in Africa and everywhere else. All the eras of that. And now the world is changing, and it's just wonderful to be liberated to know that as those forms change, there might be other things out there. For me, the most liberating thing in that pattern is something I got way years ago, a marvelous Jesuit in St. Louis, 80th birthday this year, Walter Ong, O-N-G, Ong, who was trying to teach Catholicism to get used to an evolutionary time scale. He said, no matter what, we still are sort of in Bishop Usher's chronology. I mean, our head really knows that there's been a couple billion years out there and a couple million years out there, and humans been around 150,000, but you sort of still think in terms of 6,000 and so on. And he said, so, and therefore the world sure seems old and tired. But he says, if you think 150,000 instead of 6,000, then you divide it into it, but then you think of the church divided by that new time scale, we're still in the first Christian century. We were already out beyond the suburbs of Jerusalem. Isn't it amazing? All that stuff is out there, and we don't know yet what it's going to be. My hunch about worship out there is, on the one hand, we are not going to spring free from some of the most profound images and symbols. David Hokema talked about some last night that are brought to us by folk songs. You can do anything you want. It's there. Flying to China 2 weeks ago, Harriet sat next to a nurse from Cook County Hospital. 30 years she retired from that dreadful place, I would have called it. She's in shock. That's her home. She loves it. It's all the hard cases. And all the Saturday Night Gang guys are there. And she had the one they just as soon would have let die. And he was smarting off to her. She's a nurse anesthetist. And she said, your destiny is in my hands. And I could clap this thing on your nose and, you know, you better talk differently. And he said, do you know the one about the still waters? He wanted the 23rd Psalm. I mean, the facade was broken. It's basic. Yesterday, Connie Marty talked about bread for the world. When I was at Holden in 1969, Rosemary Ruther was trying to urge on some of us that maybe we could do it with Coca-Cola and pomegranates. I'm sure she's there with bread and wine, like Dorothy Day. Bread for the world. What a marvelous slogan, because that's the basic. You can eat anything you want, but you're eating bread. Martin Thornton says, to get Christian worship going, you at least need a loaf of bread, a bottle of wine, and a river. And my hunch is you'll do that in 20 centuries, too. Because these are all primal. They're basic. The parental, the child, the bride and the groom, the hand that reaches out. Certainly the musical patterns will change. Certainly they'll change. They always have. They keep evolving. Certainly the art will change. But I think they'll be in the dialectic between knowing those texts from back there and those stories. In a world that is ever more pluralist, we've adopted a lot of things we've learned from Buddhism and Hinduism, but we fit them into the story along the way. We are a world citizenry. Our church, the church around the world, is growing fastest in sub-Saharan Africa and Latin America and the island world. That's sure changing things fast, but it's an interesting interplay between the old and the new, the southern and the northern, the black and the white or whatever. So I'm assuming that the sacred is somehow born through these stories which constantly get adapted to new circumstances. Time for one more? He always keeps refreshing me by these long-term questions. In the library yesterday, I tried out a couple on him about the narrow time scale, about the woman who heard the, who would do this, a geophysicist, an astronomer, an astrophysicist, a refrigerator expert, whoever it was saying at a certain time the sun will cool and then we'll just be a little, you know. And she came running up after a while to him and said, did you say that's going to happen in 2 billion years or 2 million years? And he said, 2 billion years. She said, for a minute I thought you said 2 million. Good reminder that times are in God's hands and Christ's coming has its own timetable. Yes, in the back row. Last one, I guess. The individual versus what? Oh, right. Oh, yes, that's a fat one. I have a whole section here I didn't use. I have a case going against the use of the concept of spirituality when divorced from the prophetic community. Spirituality is a wonderful thing. It's the contact with the sacred. It tells us wonderful things about humans. It tells us that we aren't exhausted in the practical world. I just love it that they're bestsellers, that every bookstore now has whole sections called spirituality. That's really nice. But it it can really mean now just a warm tingle in the bathtub, and then that's spirituality. And I've noticed it's part of the current bragging system, right? I'm not a member of the organized church. I'm not even religious. I am spiritual. Well, that's fine. That's your kick. I mean, somebody else gets a different kick. I'm macrobiotic, you know, whatever. What sustains? What goes through the generations? If I'm spiritual, will I really be part of that network of people who are involved? I might as an individual, but can I transplant it? To me, the excitement comes when two of them get hooked up together. When you're in a prophetic community where the real tests come mighty close to home, where you have to be reconciled to people that you see all the time, and they're not always all that much fun. A Buddy Hackett, the Jewish comic, once tells about the time the rabbi knocked on his door and was trying to sell cemetery lots at the new Jewish cemetery. And Buddy says, well, why? What's the advantage? He says, well, you get to spend eternity next to the people you're with now in the synagogue. He said, I can't stand them now. Why would I be there in eternity? We don't necessarily like all these people. Parker Palmer, he's been up here, hasn't he? His book's there. Parker Palmer says, we're a company of strangers. That's the nice thing. You don't have to be all friends. You're a company of strangers. We're brought together. And so to me, the test of the long pull is, can this wonderful energy, aesthetic energy of the spiritual, be converted into the communal? You will never find a prophetic community that looks the way it's supposed to. It has humdrum built into it. A lot of life does. It has boredom. It has apathy. It has all those things. But it at least gives you that place where that word can be heard, where the rites are there. I told somebody the other day, we were talking about organized church, back when Paul Tillich was in his prime, I heard him speak at Berkeley. He was Time Magazine cover celebrity, so everybody thought they should hear him. And, of course, nobody could understand him. Participation, you know, you couldn't understand him. And even if you could understand him, you couldn't understand him. And if you could understand him, you still couldn't understand him because it's pretty deep. But there were 6,000 students there. And I did that once with Martin Buber. I paid $5 to hear Martin Buber, the great Hasidic scholar. And he got there. We all sat there an hour and 20 minutes, didn't hear a word, but I will never forget it, right? I mean, so there's Tillich. But what do I remember of Tillich? Because I was taking lessons. I was a young bucko, and I was trying to learn how they do these things. But the thing that hit me, somebody said, why? Because his volume 3 is about the Holy Spirit and sacred and community. Why, after all this metaphysic and existence and essence, why do you talk about the church and the believing community? It's so corrupt and it's so tired and all that. And he said, well, yeah, it's where you hear these things, though. I'm translating them into English. The church is sort of like this, but you never know when it's going to be like this. It's worth the 60 minutes to get that out of it. Most of the time it's closed, right? It's defined, it's tight, and you never know when the word is going to erupt. You never know when somebody hears something they hadn't heard before, when somebody's moved by a beauty they didn't know before, when tears break forth, when an intercession has reached somebody. You never know when. It's a very inefficient system, but it is a billion people, and they tend to be inefficient, and they like that. Well, I'd love to go on, but we dare not because we get worship. I've really enjoyed this time with you. All of us Martys have. See you again soon, wherever you are, wherever we are. God be with you.